The enemy tanks have stopped.
Why?
Why waste precious tanks when they can pick us off from the air like fish in a barrel?
There are 400,000 men on this beach.
Hello and welcome to the Sound Barrier podcast from Silent London. The Sound Barrier podcast is released fortnightly and each episode discusses two films, a new release and a classic from the silent era that complements or matches it in some way. And you should know that we do this with spoilers. To find out more, visit silentlondon.co.uk or search for Silent London on iTunes or Stitcher. The Sound Barrier is hosted by me, Pamela Hutchinson. I'm the editor of Silent London, and Pete Barron.
Hello.
Today we have a special guest in the studio, Nick Dastor from The Guardian, who knows a little more than the rest of us what it's like to make a war film.
I do, yes, or I did when I was a teenager. It's all faded.
What a terribly misspent youth. The new release movie we're talking about today is a big one. It's Dunkirk, Christopher Nolan's blockbuster Second World War spectacle. So this renowned British director has created a war film that is more of an immersive multimedia experience than a screen narrative. Nolan calls it virtual reality without the goggles, and he has shot it all on 65mm film, most of it on 65mm IMAX film. Dunkirk dramatises the evacuation of the British military from a French beach in 1940, when the German forces had pushed the Allies to the brink of Europe and a UK invasion looked increasingly likely. In one of the film's three separate timelines, Nolan follows a group of soldiers who spend a week trying to get from the French sand to English soil by any vessel or means available. The Tommies fighting for survival include Fionn Whitehead, who is the closest the film has to a leading man, playing a young and terrified soldier, and Harry Styles, making his film debut as a disillusioned, although equally callow, comrade. Overseeing the operation, with 400,000 British souls to return home to our new Prime Minister Winston Churchill, is Kenneth Branagh as noble, anguished Commander Bolton. The second story takes place at sea, over one day, and follows middle-aged Briton Mr. Dawson, played beautifully by Mark Rylance, as he sets sail in his leisure boat to bring some of our brave boys home. He's joined by his son and another teenage boy, and soon by Cillian Murphy, who plays a Dunkirk evacuee stranded in the channel after a U-boat took out his ride home and many of his fellow soldiers. In the air, the film's third story is restricted to a single hour, as Spitfire pilots Tom Hardy and Jack Lowden do their best to cover the channel beneath them and keep the German bombers at bay. The film is being screened on IMAX, on 70mm, on 35mm or plain old digital, and it has gone wide, as a 12A certificate film reenacting a fabled episode in British history, starring a beloved pop star and directed by one of the world's most respected blockbuster directors, it's almost certainly going to be a hit. At its best, Dunkirk is a terrifying evocation of the blood and thunder of war, as well as its moral murkiness and heartbreaking loss of life. In one chilling moment amid the scramble for survival, Whitehead and Styles watch as a soldier calmly takes his own life in the French waters, rather than carry on waiting or trying to get home. Critics have lined up to shower the film with five-star reviews, and even Nigel Farage has thrown his weight behind Dunkirk, urging the younger generation into the cinema. One assumes he is inspired by the stoicism and resolve of British servicemen during the Second World War, rather than the Brexit jokes bouncing around social media. However, at the end of the day, or week, or hour, the events shown in Dunkirk are an evacuation, not a battle, and the jumbled timelines, as well as the lack of a hero figure, or much heroism for that matter, deny the audience the expected pleasures of a classic war film. Time will tell whether Dunkirk's lasting reputation will match its 2017 hype.
In the other corner, we're talking about the Walter Summers film, The Battles of Coronel and Falkland Islands. In fact, The Guardian in 2014 called the restored film the best war film you've never heard of, and it's a striking example of the often derided docudrama form. Filmed with considerable British Navy support, the cast list is of which ships play other ships, rather than the actors. It tells of two early skirmishes at sea in World War I. The Battles of Coronel takes up the first half hour, where when we're outnumbered and cornered, the German fleet destroyed two British ships off the coast of Chile with a loss of 1,600 men. The film then takes in the aftermath, the Admiralty, the men in the street, but also the preparation for more warfare, the shipbuilding for future battles, and the future battle that occurs off the Falkland Islands, where this strategic fueling post was laid siege by the Germans, and the British fleet ran in to save the day. The film is an impressive piece of war dramatisation, far enough away from World War I to be patriotically critical at some points, and equally, oddly fair to the enemy too, shown to have honour at certain points. The film revels in its shipbuilding montages, and there are moments when coal is being stoked and joints being welded, you can feel like you're in a Soviet silence. The film cross-cuts from the Admiralty, where every cliché is chewed to get the job done. Those boats are sailing at Wednesday 6pm, ready or not! An attitude which fatally misunderstands how nautical safety works. We see the locals in the Falklands lining up their volunteer guard, tall and short, and we see on the ships themselves slices of life, mealtimes, maintenance, preparations for the bloody battles. but it does end up as a suspense film, a war film, a chase through the Atlantic for naval honour. It's all combined to create a verisimilitude to create a cleaner version of history, one which coincidentally can bundle up a defeat with a win and posit the idea the final result is what really matters. The Battles of Coronel and Falkland Islands was a silent gala at the London Film Festival in 2014, and the BFI have done a great job, a great restoration here. And notably, there's a terrific score by Simon Dobson, played by a Royal Marine Band, which lends even more weight to the suspense. Its lack of protagonist, its attention to get the naval details right, and its surprisingly even-handed treatment of the enemy make it still seem rather modern for a war film.
So we thought that these films, both British war films, have got quite a lot in common. So, Nick, I'm going to bring you in here because I think this week was the first time you'd seen Battles of Coronel and Falkland Islands.
It was, yes. I saw that on TV, as you might expect, which was a rather different experience to my viewing of Dunkirk.
Yeah, so we've been like three little piggies here. So we've seen Dunkirk on three different formats between us. So you're the real cinephile, Nick, because you went to see it at the IMAX.
Yeah. Yes, I did. I suppose I sort of feel if you can, you might as well. I mean, I don't know. Some people say, Christopher Nolan, you know, he turns his nose up at anyone who doesn't see his films in 70mm IMAX. I don't know if that's the case, exactly what he said, but I suppose my view is if you have the chance to do it and you've got the money to do it, you might as well. So yeah, I popped along to the BFI Waterloo.
And Pete, you took the middle option.
I went to see it at the Odeon Leicester Square in 70mm.
Yeah, which is still very impressive.
Yeah.
And because I'm a noted enemy of film on film, I went to my local multiplex to see it in digital. Now, I have to say, I do feel slightly guilty, but on the other hand, I'm aware that I do champion film on film throughout the year and not just when someone who directs superhero movies tells me to. I mean, it's one of those things I've seen a lot of people getting a little bit uneasy about the fact they feel guilty that they didn't see it in 70mm IMAX, and at the end of the day, it's just a movie and you might get a chance another time.
It's a tiny difference, okay? It's great to see it in a big format. It's great to see it in a smaller format. If you're going to like it, you're going to like it in all formats.
Oh, but Pete, you haven't seen it in IMAX.
Exactly. Oh, no. So basically, in this room, only Nick has really seen the film. I mean, I'm pretty...
You two might as well just, you know, butt out.
Well, we will defer to your opinions. However, we both saw The Battles of Coronel on a big screen, so...
I've seen a big screen with live. So you didn't have actual Hans Zimmer in the auditorium.
Constantly going up his scales.
Everything that people said about this film was that it's completely immersive. You think even before the film came out, people were talking about that. And I must admit, having seen it in a perfectly reasonably sized screen, I didn't always feel that way, whereas I'd be interested to know if someone who's actually seen the film, how you feel about that.
Well, yeah, I thought it was completely overwhelming for certainly for the first half hour or so. The immersive, I'm so sick of that word, but but yeah, I mean, when he emerges onto the beach for the first time in particular, and you just the scale of what you see and just the feeling of where he is, is not, you know, not an excellent cinematic experience you get very often, and so I was felt very lucky to have that.
I mean, I did well up at that moment, actually, despite, you know, basically watching on a postage stamp. I do think, you know, I was constantly a bit worried whether I was getting the full spectacle, and I do wonder with the beach sequence whether it was whether it was the scale or whether it was just like that knowledge of I know what happens here, you know. Maybe what was making me emotional wasn't what the
film
was
so doing. I don't know if emotion is the, I mean, I suppose what I found overwhelming about it was the, just the feeling of the sort of sense of place, and that place not just geographically but in history as well. At the same time, I was trying to think of examples in film that have had the same effect on me, and one that popped into mind was Wuthering Heights, the Andrew Arnold version, the sort of some of those early scenes with the wind rattling around, and sort of at once felt very immediate, like you were there, but also like this is a kind of lost moment of history. And I think Dunkirk does a sort of similar thing for me in that early section, which is by far the most powerful for me.
Yeah. So we really want to start off by talking about that topic, really, about spectacle. Mm. And so who'd like to kick off with talking about the spectacle of Battles of Coronel and Falkland Islands?
I think what's interesting about Coronel is its sea scenes. Yeah. You know, this idea of something again that you haven't seen that well before. Here are real actual destroyers out there. Mm. You know, fighting with each other, play fighting with each other, whatever. People really in the water. I mean, it was filmed mainly around Malta, I believe, or, you know, so, and with the real ships and real sailors on those ships.
Yeah, there are a lot of actual Navy personnel on those boats. Not that that should add to the spectacle.
No, but I mean, it just adds to that, again, that sense of they know what they're doing and what would happen in certain cases. And I think there are moments, certainly the first battle, the Coronel battle, is very, very...
when the boat goes down.
Yeah, when the boat goes down, it's very affecting. And equally in a different kind of way in the sort of the chase sequence around the Falkland Islands, where tension is ramped very well by some really good montage stuff and some really good building of tension with the boats. You know, anyone who's seen Speed 2 Cruise Control will know that the representation of speed on the water is not always an easy thing to do, but it manages to do it quite well here. So
that's so wonderful that Nick brought up Andrea Arnold and you.
Jan de Bont.
When we talk about immersiveness and spectacle, people always say, oh, like a silent film. And actually, Battles of Coronel and Falkland Islands is a great example of a film that really can sort of overwhelm you a little bit because it does have quite elaborate combat scenes. It's got a lot of talk in it, actually. But, you know, I still think it's, you know, an incredible achievement on that front. But I don't know what you think, Nick, but I'm not sure it can hold a candle to Dunkirk for spectacle.
No, I mean, obviously, as mentioned, I was watching it on a small screen, so it doesn't help. And I do tend to sort of fidget a bit and not properly kind of pay attention in something where it's setting up a sense of place and where things are. So I got very confused about the various ships and where they were. There was a point later on where
are you sure you're not talking about Dunkirk?
It does on purpose.
Where later on where the Germans are surprised that the two battleships are in the harbour of the Falklands, and so I was like, okay, well, I've got the handle on what's happening here. And then suddenly the canopus was suddenly mentioned. I was like, well, where does that fit in? What are they doing? Are they here as well? I did find it hard to get at times a sense of the what was at play in terms of the where they were on the ocean.
And you found that quite distancing, whereas I think like Dunkirk does that in a way to ramp up the spectacle. You don't know where you are. All you know is that there's cold water and
exactly. Bombs. That's sort of it's making a virtue of it there. Whereas I think you probably appreciate the Battle of Coronel and Falkland Islands more if you did have an understanding of where the different players were.
Well, I think we'll talk about its narrative strategy later, because I think it's quite interesting the way they're so at odds. One is desperately trying to tell you where you are all the time, but that requires sort of concentrating and not going with the flow of the thing. Yeah. So when I think about spectacle and Dunkirk, I mean, there are many amazing sequences. I think when the mole is beginning to lean because of the ship's pressure, I was completely on the edge of my seat. But I was thinking of, is it Fionn Whitehead who's underwater and the bomb goes off and he claps his ears over his hands? And it really goes that...
Yeah.
It was an image of being immersed in a film as much as anything else. So what were your feelings about IMAX War?
It was quite... I saw it with my sister, and afterwards, I think her first words were just, my God, that was intense. You can't... It really puts you through the ringer when you've got that kind of scale of the screen and the noise. I mean, the Hans Zimmer... I mean, it's hard to disentangle what's the score and what's the sound effects, but, you know, it was really pummeling at him. I mean, after a while, I thought he could do with some periods of a bit more quiet, just to just give you a bit of a... I don't know. I don't know if it exactly lost its impact, but maybe I just could have done with a break. I'm not sure. But I felt like I was time frame. It was extremely... It was just overwhelming. Yeah,
pleasant.
No, it wasn't pleasant.
No, I mean, it's not supposed to be pleasant.
No.
But
No. We're not going to rank films on how pleasant you feel while watching them.
Can I shout though for Coronel and Falkland Islands montage sequences?
Yeah, the effort is my favourite bit.
Because if we talk about the spectacle in that, actually the putting the ships together stuff and the welding and the stoking the fires. Mm. There's a couple of little wonderful montage sequences in the middle of the film which are really, really great.
Yeah.
I mean, very much out of the Soviet textbook, but no worse for it.
I mean, it shows you, I mean, Walter Summers is one of those names that is pretty much forgotten by most cinephiles these days, but he really was a tremendous director, particularly of action. Mm. And I think, you know, he takes those shipbuilding sequences and shoots them like they're a combat scene, basically.
Yeah.
You know, really, really exciting. Your tension there is more, you know, will these boats that won't be ready until Friday be ready on Wednesday? But when you think about it, you know, that's what it all comes down to. You know, you can't fight the war without the ships, right?
I mean, it's interesting because I've seen an argument elsewhere, I mean, where people are talking around Dunkirk about why why are there only three planes and all that kind of stuff? Why aren't there so many boats? And of course, that is the upshot of a lacking of not having the equipment, you know, and the stuff that's going on in the back rooms, in the factories, in the mines. I saw Proud Valley last night, the Paul Robeson film. And again, it's like, how important is having coal to running a war effort? And so sometimes a film, and, you know, obviously Dunkirk is about being there on the ground, but because it does drop you in media res, and for that spectacle reason, you don't necessarily have that sense of why these things happen like this. Whereas Coronel is trying to give you more of a rounded picture, perhaps because it's something it can film and do well. And, you know, we do have the man in the Admiralty, less spectacle-wise, just standing there looking worried and occasionally banging the desk and making ridiculous comments about getting ships ready when they won't be ready and stuff like that.
He's our Kenneth Branagh.
I was going to say, he's not that dissimilar.
Kenneth Branagh was just wonderful. Just like, I am going to look as unexcited as possible, and that's going to make me look brave.
Yes.
Brilliant. I mean, I thought he was fantastic in it. You know, I'm trying to think of the moments of a spectacle in Dunkirk that really meant something to me. And I think, like you were saying, like the first beach, when the boys were drowning, and when they were like being shot at in the hull of the ship, you know, I think the U-boat hits the ship. But it's the beautiful patriotic moment where all the little Englander boats come towards them, home comes for them.
Yes.
It's amazing. I'm just going to say that, spoiler alert, the final sequence with Tom Hardy meant absolutely nothing to me, but I could tell that probably looked really impressive on IMAX.
Interesting. The air sequence was my least favourite of the three time frames. I wasn't that interested in it, but I think it had a certain emotional punch for me when he was coming down. It made me think afterwards of this is maybe a bit of a stretched comparison, but for me, as I've mentioned, it was very front-loaded, the film, in terms of the impact it had.
Yeah.
I felt like the impact that it had on me in the opening reel, I suppose, really carried me through the rest of the film, and I had problems with certain parts of the rest of it. And it sort of occurred to me afterwards, it was a bit like kind of Tom Hardy kind of coasting without fuel. He ran out of fuel, but enough has happened that he can land just about, even if he's on the wrong side of the channel.
Brilliant metaphor. I mean, it's one of the problems with the flying sequences is unless a vessel has been hit, it all looks rather beautiful and graceful, whatever. So you don't necessarily see that danger. You literally can't see his fuel running out, which is an interesting choice on their part, you know, not to give you those sort of tags. But, well, I think we probably all agree that the air sequence was our least favourite, no? I agree with Nick.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I like all three sequences. I think my granddad was a Polish airman, so air sequences mean a bit more to me, and came through at Dunkirk as well. So there is quite a personal relationship in the film that I might come onto a bit later. So I didn't mind it. I suppose the thing for me about the air sequence, and particularly that very last sequence, is that I think the film doesn't make it anywhere near clear enough that he has basically just surrendered to the enemy.
Yeah.
And he
spoilers
has,
here, yes.
But he has made a choice to do that rather than ditch
the
water.
You mean it doesn't make that clear earlier?
No, the way it doesn't make it clear when he's getting out of the plane and setting fire to it, that's because he's about
surrendered,
to be captured.
Yeah.
And he
I thought that
in.
Was quite obvious. I thought there was little about the end sequence that wasn't very
obvious.
Okay,
yeah, I think it might just be me then. I think it wasn't because it wants to stick down.
I wasn't clear what he was doing in the period up to that. I wasn't sure what was happening. I did get confused. And I think because you see the plane in the different time frames, and that I did get a little bit lost there. But yeah, I think I had got it by the end.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we've got so much we want to say about Dunkirk. I'm going to have to hurry to score either the film that we're now going to call Coronel. Coronel or Dunkirk. Who wins for spectacle? I'm going to go to Pete first, just to be fair to our guest.
I will go for Dunkirk for spectacle.
And Nick?
I will also go for Dunkirk.
I feel I should go for Coronel, but I'm going to go for Dunkirk, even though I saw it on a postage stamp on my mobile phone, 20 feet away with my, you know, earphones in. I do admit that
you saw it on quite a big screen in digital.
This was as Pete suggested, obviously there's been a lot of talk about the Hans Zimmer score for Dunkirk. I think, it, as you said, it's a really important part of the film. And we've all seen Coronel with this, I think, quite staggeringly brilliant Royal Marine Band score. Should we talk about Hans Zimmer first? Because what he does seem to be frightfully effective, I think. There's a lot of ticking clocks, and then there's a little bit of Elgar, isn't there, really?
Yeah. Now, remind me, what is the uplifting Elgar bit? Which section is that in?
Because I can't remember exactly when it's used because of the timelines crossing.
It's at the end. They use it, yeah. Swelling at the end under the Churchill speech.
I feel like there's also another bit where it sort of changes tack.
There might be one earlier.
But anyway, yeah, the general theme is just a kind of rumble of ticking and kind of low-end frequencies I physically was actually worried, is this doing my eardrums damage? Because it wasn't like
that loud.
It wasn't so much that, I don't think it was the volume of it as much, even though it was loud, as the kind of it was such a rumble that I kind of felt it was kind of burying into my head, and I was starting to get a bit paranoid that I was doing myself damage. Okay. But it was, yeah, it was unpleasant, but it was effective.
Well, I sometimes have attacks of claustrophobia in the cinema, which is a slight problem for me. And so when someone comes in and they start ramping up the tension like that, and it very early on you had that kind of, like, I don't know how you describe it, but you know, the tick-tock, I began to be worried that I wasn't going to be able to handle it. And it was interesting, it's that sense of panic, which like lead character is feeling at the same time, and you think, how will I ever get through this, which is ridiculous watered down version of what someone might feel in an actual combat situation.
Yeah, yeah. There is always, whenever you people raise the idea of something being like, you know, makes you feel like you're really there, you're always like, ooh, I really want to pull back from that, because you're like, that just sounds quite, yeah, implying that you know what it's like to be in Dunkirk by having seen a film. But you know,
it made me feel like I'd had too many coffees more than I'd.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is partially because Nolan talks about it himself, okay, about the how closely he worked with Zimmer and the sound effects people as well to make it all the same thing. It is a soundtrack. Then the soundtrack is, whilst if you listen to the soundtrack on Spotify, it doesn't have all the gunshots and so on in it. You know, they are timed in a Baby Driver way to hit the way they do. But also, he talks about a thing called the Shepherd Tone, which is a musical motif. It's basically where you have three tones an octave apart, which are constantly going up. So this causes tension. What happens is when one of them gets unfeasibly high, you slowly fade it out. You start a tone below and it fades in, so it never reaches the top, but constantly ramps up tension.
So you're constantly feeling that something's about to happen.
And he's used it in a lot of his films. He uses it in Inception, in Dark Knight Returns, Dark Knight, and this time, I mean, he spoke about it in the interview last week, so that's why I wanted to bring it up as well, that's what he was trying to do with the action as well. So he was trying to cut the action with the music, but also constantly heightening tension, which he does to a degree of success. But the problem with the Shepherd Tone is it never resolves itself.
Yeah.
And so it's once you've ramped up tension for an hour and a half, where do you go? Well, you glide a plane, or you get a bottle of beer put through a window. But so that's what's going on there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the other way around in Coronel, the score is written to a film that already exists.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is one that understands exactly how it should work, but also uses appropriate instruments in an appropriate way with some very clever use of repeating motifs.
Yeah.
Now, you actually saw it being done live with the band.
So here's the dirty little secret about that. I saw the score performed live. Now, the thing to know about Dobson's score is it is for the Royal Marine Band. It's performed by them. It's actually impossible to perform. And even when he was recording it, he had horn players passing out. It is physically as much effort as getting those boats ready. You can't play brass instruments at that intensity for that long. So there were actually pre-recorded bits, I think, when we watched it live. You know, it's pretty much impossible to do the whole thing. I think it's a fantastically complex and magnificent score. I have to say, I think that, you know, a war film is not my choice of movie, but I think every time I've watched Coronel again and again, it's been the score that's really drawn me back each time. You know, that I think that it has exactly the right sense of gravitas without doing something, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it, as cheap as just trying to scare you. You know, I think that the score in Coronel, it represents the fact that what's happening is important, but without trying to use tricks, I think, to make it any more tense than it is. Maybe that's what's needed, but I was not a fan of the Hans Zimmer score for Dunkirk at all.
No. Yeah. It is hard to take it away from the rest of the film. You know, it is such an important part of the film. that I think if it doesn't, I suppose you can't like it, you might not like it, but if you do you not think it was effective?
Or I thought it was almost too effective, yeah. But as you say, it's almost like it was going round and round again. Like the film in many ways, I kind of wanted it to go somewhere.
But it is interesting how what you're saying about the mechanics of the way it composed sort of totally fits in with Nolan's kind of approach to directing. This is all kind of, you know, things slotting together and
And I think the way it sort of cross cuts between the three stories would, you know, in another director's hands, be an opportunity to use a different tactic for each section, but actually, of course, it ramps up through those, which may be a mistake, because I think it doesn't give you that breather. I think one thing for me as well about Dunkirk, and, you know, talking about Dunkirk to family as an actual event, is of course as someone, you know, my granddad was there. And the one thing the film doesn't really do very well for me is the waiting.
Mm.
It's not so much, it does do that, and there is that in there, but actually what waiting for, because the way that the telescope time for the 1 week section goes, here's a bit, and then now it's got to be 3 days later, it's got to be 4 days later. Where are we in between? Where are they sleeping? Where are they going? You know, because my understanding was people just slouch back into town and just get kip wherever they could in shops and so on, and then constantly be going back to the beach, or constantly, you know, there were people standing on the mole, but there weren't people there constantly.
People didn't stand around. Up
which,
for 10 days.
Which kind of explains the kind of question that people have raised about why doesn't it look like there are that many people there?
Yeah.
You know, kind of use a bit of CGI. Yeah. Where, that would explain it if they're not all there at once.
No. I mean, it would be madness to be standing on that beach when you're being bombed as well. So.
And also, there was a thing that happened on the 24th of May called the Halt Order, where the Germans decided to let us go, more or less, because they knew they were going to get us later.
And if you're on the ground, you didn't know that.
No.
And certainly you thought you would be bemused why they didn't finish off the job.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been very suspenseful, but I think the idea of hanging around day after day and the kind of suspense that would have been, I don't think that is the kind of suspense that's represented in the film. I think it's more immediate threat that the film is so excellent at representing. I wonder what Hans Zimmer's "I Wonder If I'll Get Home Today" music is, rather than the kind of like, "Oh, they're going to shoot at my head right now" music.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I think they're two different kinds of tension.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to say about the score of Coronel was the sections where it goes to the machinery and what it does there. That's what sticks most in my head, are the kind of suddenly when you get these kind of polyrhythms or whatever it is, of kind of very different kind of feel.
Sounds like they're actually like banging rivets into anvils and things like that. Yeah. I mean, it's really kind of hefty score that makes you think of big metal boats.
Yeah.
And
Perfectly appropriate score, and really good.
Yeah. I mean, I've already said which way I'm going to vote on this one. I will take the bullet and go first. I'm going to vote for Coronel for score, even though I'm sure everyone in the world will disagree with me.
Nick?
I'm a bit difficult with this one because I haven't decided about the Hans Zimmer, because I think I almost would like to see it again with a totally different score or without a score, because it's so hard to separate it that you kind of don't know whether it's a good thing or not. It is overwhelming, and I don't know if that's a good thing or not. But I will go with Dunkirk again.
Okay.
I will go for Coronel.
Hey!
Partially the reason you just said, actually, that a lot of people have said, of course, Dunkirk is very much a silent film. It's like, well, okay, well, let's treat it like that one, and let's try it with a different score.
Yeah, it would be interesting, actually, to screen it properly as a silent film, because there's, as a lot of people said, there's very little dialogue, and there's not too much sort of narrative prompt dialogue. So, you know, there's not much that's said or heard that can only be expressed that way. You know, I mean, a lot of the chit chat, you know, you have a handful of intertitles. Yeah. It'd be interesting to have some other people have a go at it, because it's so obvious, as we're saying, that you might want to try having different kinds of music for different strands, say.
Yeah.
I'd be intrigued to see what people do. I'm sure that'll never happen.
I'm sure it will happen.
I think if Hans Zimmer and Chris Nolan have worked so closely together for so long, and, you know, what do we know?
He's coming back round!
But realism, want to talk about realism. So how really real did Dunkirk feel?
Yes, it did. I mean, I think, you know, in the moment, I think one of the things that it does is the idea of war being hell, and in this case, say 12A hell, but nevertheless,
yeah,
hell.
That was one problem I did have with it.
See, it wasn't a problem I had with, because I think we've had our gratuitous 18 limbs flying everywhere war film. We've had Saving Private Ryan. Mm. We've had that stuff.
Axel Ridge.
Yeah, I mentioned that as well. So it's fine because you know what's happening there, and in the end, these people are dying. There's the implied crushing of bodies. There's the burning. Mm. There's the, so we know these people are dying. You know, and I don't mind that. And I think the sort of randomness of it within the narrative structure and the carefully constructed conceit within Dunkirk, it felt like it was at least attempting to create the sensation for me. Whether that's a real one or not, I don't know, but it was unpleasant. It was scary, as I imagine it would be on the ground, just in a different kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of give mad props to Dunkirk on this score, to be honest. I think that when I think about Dunkirk, I mean, I'm not the kind of person who reads books about military strategy, history and things like that, but it's the stories about Dunkirk that always stuck with me. And, you know, this is what this film was absolutely excellent at doing. It brings to life all the things you half remember from school or from the odd documentary you watch. And, you know, the bread and jam and tea that they hand them when they get onto the boat, and the way that people turn on each other, and obviously everything to do with the boats coming up from the south coast, which is, I mean, so the small boat, the movie-sized film, the movie-sized storyline was my favourite. The Mark Rylance story is absolutely my favourite. But I did think that it felt almost too real sometimes. I wanted it to kind of like, you know, step back from saying, and you know it would have been like this, and you know it would have been like this, and allow itself to tell a story. But yeah, I thought that everything felt very tangible to me.
Yeah, I suppose the thing that sticks with me, just repeating myself, I suppose, is Fionn Whitehead's opening section when he just wanders through the town. Well, not wanders through the town, wanders onto the beach after coming running hell full of through the town, and just feels, you know, where am I? What the hell am I doing? Where do I go? And you can just see everyone, you know, acting, doing things, and you're not sure where you go and what you do.
Gets into the wrong queue, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I suppose I immediately felt that very, very real. Like I could imagine that being that person, just wandering from place to place and trying to find what to do.
Because that's the horror of Dunkirk, isn't it? That, you know, you've sort of got out, but you can't get out. I mean, imagine it's like the worst nightmare ever. You know, you can't get away from the terrible scene of unspeakable violence. You're stuck in it, and you might. Well, I kept thinking about the dilemma of these little boys, really, because they're so young. They're so young. And I think one of the great things Christopher Nolan did was cast so many young actors, so many young boys. And, you know, what do you do? Do you elbow your way to the front? Well, obviously, that's not particularly gallant behaviour, but what would, if you don't elbow your way to the front, if you don't push in front of someone else, if you don't take every opportunity to get out, then, you know, you're basically breaking your own mother's heart, aren't you? Yeah. I mean, that's what I kept thinking about. I just kept thinking, how do you act in this queue, in this crowd, in this boat? You know, the moment when the young lads are trapped, they've trapped themselves in the trawler, and there are Germans shooting at them, and they start turning on each other. It's pretty despicable.
I found that bit a little bit it felt a little bit artificial to me compared with some of the rest. It felt like here we're going to put in a little section that's a kind of you know, let's have a little balloon debate kind of thing. Let's see
it was a play, wasn't it, in itself? Who gets out of the trawler?
I just sort of felt at that point that, like, you could feel Christopher Nolan kind of having seen some old film and thinking, oh yeah, let's have a bit of suspense here.
Basically Lifeboat, yeah. And he needs a narrative tension, I guess, at that point, just to add to that story and pull it out. But also, I think he wanted to tell a story about the evacuation being a British evacuation, and it was a British evacuation. Lots of, you know, plenty of French did get evacuated. My grandfather was Polish, he got evacuated, but, you know, it was Britain first. It's your army, that's what you do, as you're saying. So, but what do you do in that situation? You're scared, you're running, you've got nowhere to go. The Battle of France was a rout. You know, we just ran back, and then where are you?
I mean, it is just terrifying. It's one of those films where, you know, I met someone after the film, and they hadn't seen it. They weren't interested in seeing it, and I was having to stop myself and talk about it quite a lot, because, you know, all these things are running through your head. It did get under your fingernails. You know, you do feel the dirt and the fear and the massive amounts of cold water.
Yeah.
And the foam on the beach.
Oh, the nasty foam.
And the oil.
Yeah,
it's a dirty, dirty film. I'm a slightly bit cynical about the 12A bit of it. There wasn't even one sort of gory bit at the beginning to scare you and make you realise that all the other things would... When the film is 12A and it's got a member of One Direction in, you think, gosh, you want to make a lot of money.
Well, they are in the show business.
Yes,
and,
it's true.
You know, let's be saying business is part of it. But these are compromises we make. But I don't think it's a problematic compromise.
Does Nolan have to make compromises? Or does he? No. Maybe he does. Maybe because Dunkirk is such an unattractive story to tell. It's basically a military operation. It's not a glorious patriotic war movie. Maybe he did have to make compromises.
If he wants to put an IMAX camera in a Spitfire, then probably does.
He's in such a strange position. There's so few people that can make these big budget films off their own scripts. I mean, I know this time at least he's working from a real life story, but I don't know whether he's given, like, he's one of these rare people who's just given the money to do it because he's Chris Nolan. I don't know whether he does or whether he's made compromises.
It's him and the Wachowskis are getting that money, and even they don't get given it anymore. So
because I remember thinking, when I went to see Inception, which I did see at cinema, and I was filled with regret. I remember thinking he's basically made a film in which he could show any scene he chooses to show, and I thought that what he chose to show, in my opinion, was a little bit staid. And so I thought it would be really interesting to see what he does with the situation where he has sort of quite a grey landscape. He's got a particular grim thing to show us. And, generally, I think, he's more interested in realism than he thinks, possibly. Or that you might assume if you look at the fact that he's done the Batman films. Yeah. Even something like Memento, which, it's great, but it was such a flashy idea. We're all very excited about it at the time. We need to talk about realism in Coronel.
I was just saying, when you were mentioning the thing being dirty, I did notice how, like, they did really pile on the dirt quite a lot on some of the sailors in Coronel, more than I'd expect. Not just the colliers, but, you had that scene of them at dinner and, they're pretty damn filthy.
People are quite dirty in silent films. Yeah, are quite dirty, but it's true. I think you kind of assume that everything's going to be immaculate white faces and eyeliner and so on. But the realism in Coronel is kind of, it's almost like it's there, but do you feel it? Because it is there, because these are real Navy ships. There are real sailors on those ships. We're like 99% certain.
Well, of course, if you think about the ships, they're actually there. There are actually British ships playing the German ships, and it's very clear to tell from the two turrets and the gun rig. So I read some comments in to that Guardian article I quoted earlier, where people do go down into that level of nerdery, and that will always happen around war films. Mm-hmm. But as you say, these are real battleships, real destroyers.
But then you say, the scenes in Westminster, the scenes with the Admiralty, of people sort of passing telegrams back and forth, it kind of jumps you out of that, because we feel, I think, modern view of warfare is we should definitely prioritise the depiction of, the poor people at the front, the people who are in the thick of it. And this film just keep coming back to show us, admirals and captains having banquets and in offices.
Yeah, the whole thing is traditional in that sense of it being a kind of top-down thing where you kind of this is the command, and then we'll get a shot of what lots of shots of what the Navy are doing, but it will be very much like at the direction of the whole film is kind of being directed by what the commanders think should be done. And I suppose what's interesting, I think, about Christopher Nolan, the way he does it is he doesn't go fully on the kind of modern thing of just focus on the people at the bottom. There is a kind of sense to it all by having that kind of the air, sea and land structure to it. It does work as a kind of military command picture as well, even though it's a sort of even though it's very chaotic. It's basically going, they know what they're doing. It's a kind of the guys in charge know what they're doing and they do the right thing.
Pacing up and down the beach. I don't know the name of the actor, but sort of Kenneth Branagh's second in command.
James.
It was almost reassuring to know that somebody was looking after those lads, because you thought, we've seen some of them get off into all kinds of mischief. Maybe someone should be keeping these lines in order and keeping morale up.
And then from a realism point of view, though, to go back to that kind of, the structure you say about Coronel being, this kind of traditional thing, I think it's kind of invented by Coronel, some of that stuff, to do the back room, the front line. There is no, you know, and there's lots of World War II movies, certainly, which are, here are the decisions in the back, in the office, here are the decisions with the guys on the front, you know, and they get half a personality between them. I mean, in Coronel, they barely get that. But here is a decision being made here. Here is how it's being carried out. And I think in the period it's at as well, 1927, we're 10 years after the war.
So the people in the cinema know whether it's real or not.
Yes.
That's the issue, which you don't necessarily get with Dunkirk. There are many survivors of Dunkirk watching that film.
So the people know it's real, but also we're in the period, certainly, where the criticism of naval command, of the British High Command, is relatively high. That, you know, they neglected people died needlessly, and, you know, 1600 people dying in that first battle is huge. So the way that these two battles are packaged together as, you know, a victory and a defeat as good as a victory, you know, here's this thing and that one, we lost that one, but we won this one, so it's okay, it's a score draw at best, and it's a score draw that we sort of won, is something that the Admiralty will be keen on. You know, we're still going to talk about war. We're still going to talk about men signing up. You know, we're still massively low on men at that point. So there's a propaganda aspect outside of war.
I was interested. You say you feel that was a kind of a high point of skepticism after the first one, because I wasn't sure whether that had kind of passed a little bit or whether that was still in the ascendancy. And also, I wondered how much of the film was, you know, how much the Navy were involved with it and how much
they were highly involved, and
did they, and was it funded by them? And
I don't think it was funded, but I mean, you know, I mean, Walter Summers himself had been a soldier in the First World War, so you got people who were involved in the actual events making the film, but yes, there is an intention to show that, you know, this is what our Navy is like, this is our capability. It's reassuring for people to know that all around the world Britain is keeping peace.
It's not like a government information film in that sense. But it still has that
it's
backdrop,
a studio picture.
Yeah.
And it's like those sort of World War II movies where they get the Navy involved in that, and so therefore it saves them loads of money on shooting costs. And you know, it's quid pro quo. If you're going to have our boats, then here are things you can and can't do. I'm sure the scripts went through the ministry a number of times before it was signed off.
Yeah, it did. And the locations and things like the Falklands and so on. And the Falklands were the people who complained.
Yeah.
Because they sort of depicted a bit rustic.
Yeah. Yes.
Almost as circus freaks in some sequences.
I wouldn't quite go that far. It's a bit Dad's Army.
Dad's Army was 50% munchkins.
Yeah. I mean, it's realism, but I think, you know, it's hard to look at it in 2017 and not just see, I can see that this story is being shaped. I can see that we're talking about brave decisions that people make. I mean, one of the things that they do is, you know, they keep naming all the officers, because obviously these are people that you'd read about in the newspapers, but there'll always be like a few scenes of like Tommy heroics that people can identify, you know, their lost loved ones with. Whereas, you know, Christopher Nolan isn't concerned about that at all. You know, he's not concerned about making our boys look good, really. You know, he shows quite a lot of unheroic behaviour. Yeah, quite frankly, he shows you why, though. Yeah. You know, he's not trying to reassure anyone.
No, yeah. saying what would you do in this situation? You would do this. It is hard.
I mean, just on a technical level, I was impressed with, I mean, the Coronel, you know, when the ships are on fire and stuff, it looked amazing. I was really impressed with how realistic it looked in that sense.
Yeah, I am. So one of my ancestors died in the Battle of Jutland, and I showed this film to my dad, and he found it like incredibly moving, having read about that. And, you know, it doesn't look like some people floating in a tank, you know. No. It really does look, you know, it's incredibly realistic, I think, for any era of cinema, let alone the fact that, you know, some 1920s films are definitely are that good, but, like, you know, things made a little bit earlier could be a little bit less convincing. I mean, it's so hard, because I feel like I'm like this grudging chip on the shoulder person, where I think, well, Christopher Nolan can do whatever he wants, so of course his film looks great.
Well, if we're going to score it on budget, technical ability and technical process, then Coronel has to win it.
Okay. You
know, so I'm going to give it to Coronel for the ability to make a realistic film in its time, in its way, and how it made it. And one that I think that works from a docudrama point of view. I think maybe Dunkirk is more emotionally real.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like this is, I totally sympathise with what Pete said there, but I feel like I would be kind of not true to myself if I didn't say that I felt Dunkirk was more real, in the sense of just the sense of you feeling like you're there, I suppose.
Well, it was wrapped around you, like 90 feet tall. Yeah. I'm struggling with this one, but I have decided to go for Coronel, just because I think even after having watched Dunkirk and thought about it so much, I rewatched Coronel, and yeah, when the Good Hope goes down, I found it really remarkably terrifying. And actually, there was something about the fact that you linger on the consequences or something like that a little bit longer than in Dunkirk that it was quite emotionally real for me as well. Anyway, I mean, you know, they're both very strong on this.
Yes.
So I'm going to talk about, next thing I want to talk about is the depiction of the enemy. Now, I mean, I just think it's interesting that they have completely different approaches to the enemy. So Christopher Nolan chooses not to show any Germans at any point, right? So we don't see any enemy. We see their
shadows occasionally. Yeah, we hear their guns.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that first bullet, I remember sitting in the cinema and thinking, that's it now. I've heard that first bullet, which is so loud and so terrifying. I thought, this is it now. You know, I'm under fire for the next hour and a half.
And you were.
And I was. Whereas Walter Summers goes entirely the other way. He shows the enemy quite a lot, and he actually shows him in a relatively good light, particularly von Spee. So, and actually, this film was shown and quite liked in Germany.
The enemy in Dunkirk are a force of nature. They're not people. They're not a thing. And I think there is an issue because the Nazis are such, I know, are history's number one bad guys. You know, it's like the minute you see a swastika, it's this is a terrible situation on the beach because they are the terrible evil Nazis, rather than this is a terrible situation on the beach because this is where they've been led to at the end of a battle that they've lost.
Yeah.
And actually, the Nazis are kind of doing them a favour here by not going and destroying them.
But, yeah.
So it's clever. I agree with you. It's clever. I think it means that it becomes less of a war film and more of a disaster stroke survival horror film.
Yeah, it's kind of like a disaster film,
And I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think it was probably the right thing to do. I mean, I suppose I have, without knowing much at all about the real history of Dunkirk, people's complaints about the absence of other forces, the French particularly.
Well, they get told to go away quite early on.
Yeah.
A nice British man says, Anglais seulement, and there we go. They tossle off.
I mean, the French car has an extra 10 minutes at the end where we go, we'll bring a couple of you over. It's okay. You'll be the free French in Britain.
Yeah. But they I mean, I can't see how you would introduce a little bit of the Germans without, you know, the whole thing being unbalanced. You're certainly not going to present them in the same way that Coronel. I think the problem is that we don't really know a lot. It's incredibly confusing anyway about what the German command were doing at this point anyway, and no one quite knows why they stopped. And we really don't. I mean, and as Chris Nolan said, he doesn't really want to get into it being the politics and the history. In that sense, he's more interested, well, he says he's more interested in suspense and whatever else, so, you know, in that sense it's just a backdrop to that for him.
But don't we need a new Hitler sequence ranting somewhere that we can dub with any pop culture meme that comes along?
I mean, yeah, you just need another whole timeline where you have, you know, Hitler somewhere and Churchill somewhere. But, you know, I think it's quite interesting that all you feel, well, not all you feel, but I think Dunkirk is trying to get you to feel the pull of home rather than the sort of push of the enemy, and it actually ends up with a bit of both. I thought it was interesting that both films ended with this sort of gesture of magnanimity, which is in Coronel, it's when they decide to pick up all the Germans and save them and to stop shooting, you know, basically.
And the dog.
And at the end of Dunkirk, where Kenneth Branagh is staying on his mole for the French. I mean, it's interesting actually in both films that there's a lot of talk about save the ships for another occasion, like the Germans have to save their fleet. It's so not about winning so much as it is about having ships left over at the end of the day, which is just terrifying. The only bit of Churchill we get is obviously via the newspaper read out in Whitehead's faltering tones.
We will fight them on the beaches. We're on the landing grounds.
I think that was completely botched, that whole sequence. I think the idea was that you felt the vulnerability in those words, but somehow I didn't because...
He read them too well.
It didn't work for me either, and I don't know whether it was... It almost felt like, oh, here's a way of getting in so that we have to, you know, how are we going to do this without it being cheesy? Oh, we'll do it this way. But I just don't think you needed probably to do it at all. I don't think it added... I don't know if he was sort of aiming for a kind of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern the Dead thing of like, kind of, here's the small character kind of, you know, playing his part of the way you've seen it, the other way around from the way you've normally seen it. But it was just, I don't know. Well, the whole end... I mean, I don't know whether... Did you feel... The whole homecoming section was
terrible.
Yes.
terrible. Terrible was over-egging it, but not very good.
I didn't like it at all. I thought, this is where Harry Styles doesn't learn. That guy couldn't look at us. He was blind, Harry. He was blind. Thought that the film just couldn't achieve what it wanted to achieve at the end.
It didn't know how to end because it didn't tell the story. In a narratively proper way in the first place. So it couldn't end properly.
I generally agree. I wasn't a fan of the ending. And I thought...
Except for the Weymouth Herald.
The Weymouth Herald section I did like because...
Yeah, I love that.
It was a little bit sentimental, but I thought that was fun. But also I think in another sense that was important because, yes, there wasn't a kind of satisfactory end to the story. But I think... If you can take that as being deliberate, that there wasn't any shape to it other than it being a successful retreat, that what he's trying to do there is like present it that everyone has to make their own kind of stories about these things.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
So you can weave the story for this poor boy's family that he was a hero, and. It kind of also went alongside the words from Harry Styles where he says why are they all cheering us, all we did was escape, survived.
Survived,
I think you're right. And then it does become that you get that sense of how it all can shift in the mind, the way it seems to them at the time, suddenly they get a sense of how it sees, you get a narrative shape to it from someone else entirely.
Yeah.
And that's the way that it ends up being spun in British kind of memory. And I suppose that's what it's doing, I suppose.
I mean, I think if the events of Dunkirk had been followed by the Germans actually invading Britain, we'd have a very different opinion of Dunkirk. And that's one of those things, I think a lot of the people, the way that Fionn Whitehead reads that speech out, which is basically saying, this is how we're going to cope when they land. Mm. And Harry Styles saying, oh, everyone's going to hate us because we just saved ourselves, and even someone criticising the RAF guy, what did you do? I think there's quite a really moving idea in there, the idea that this could have been seen as a terrible, shabby thing and like the last thing before we all surrendered but that isn't what happened. And I don't think I felt like I even had to put that interpretation on the sort of messy collection of scenes we saw. I just felt the ending was smothered in sentiment, which we've been resisting so much for the rest of the film.
It felt
completely unearned, apart from the one bit of the film that I liked.
I mean, I think we have got away from the enemy a bit here.
We have got away from the enemy.
As they do in Dunkirk.
I do think it's interesting. The reason that you can't see the enemy, I think, in Dunkirk is that it doesn't do context very well.
Yeah.
And that's fine if you don't want to do context, but you suddenly start thinking, yeah, but history, I do need a little bit. Whereas Coronel realises that it's more terrifying if the enemy's just like you, I suppose.
Yeah, and honourable. And also, there is again, going back to what we were saying before, there is a geopolitical thing to say, right? This is Germany in 1927. They are now our allies. They are now our friends for a few years. And so we want to be saying to them that if people died, then they died as part of the war, which we now all look back and say was a terrible war, and we are now new people who are in charge. And so,
yeah. I mean, I read after, and at the time I was watching it, I was struck by the depiction of the Germans, and then I read afterwards that there'd been another German film a few years previously that had similarly presented the English in a very kind of fair way, and it was seen as a sort of return favour. In those sense, but there was that bit before the before he says let's raise a glass to our adversaries. There is the people just before that who said let's sort of drink to the bride.
They have a cake, with the boat in it. I think he doesn't suggest that all the Germans are noble all the time, much like all British people. It's just sort of saying this one guy, the guy who went down with the ship, right?
Yeah.
It's a bit like pointing out, making sure that you tell the right story about a real person, much like, the Weymouth Herald.
Yeah.
Tell the right story. I mean... I give Walter Summers, who was a pretty jingoistic fellow, I think so. I'm not entirely sure. I give him credit for trying his damnedest, to be fair, to not be beastly to the Germans.
Don't be beastly to the Germans.
At first I thought that the depiction of the enemy as sort of voiceless faceless terror in Dunkirk was very clever, and I still think it's mostly very effective because there's that feeling that a bomb or a gun or a bullet can come from anywhere. Of course, as the film goes on, you're just like, there will be another one along in a minute, you know, rather than I didn't have that suspense. So I am going to go for Coronel. I know I sound like I'm quite predictable, but Pete?
I'm going to go for Dunkirk because whilst I think it's clever, it works. I think it works the kind of film it is. It makes it the film it is.
Well, I'll go for Coronel. I won't vote for an absence, so yeah, I'll go for Coronel for my first. Yeah.
I put down character. So there's quite a lot of characters. Well, there's not that many characters actually to talk about. There's a lot of people, but there aren't that many characters in the film. I was really, really taken by beautiful characterization of Mr. Dawson and everyone else on the boat in Dunkirk. And I kind of feel that Dunkirk showed me how you can make a beautifully crafted characterization within the context of a melee war film kind of thing. And then didn't do it everywhere else. No one else really gets the same treatment. But I just want to say that I thought that the boat sequence in Dunkirk was absolutely wonderful, and I thought that the characters in that scenario, so it's the guy goes out on his own private boat, rejects the Navy. We don't really know why.
I think because they're going to basically requisition the boats, and he thinks he can do it anyway, so why give them my boat? They might muck it up. I can do it.
But he really, you know, he's so intense, you really want to see why he's doing it. And then with Cillian Murphy, who doesn't want to go back to Dunkirk, who can blame him, and the young lads, and again there's a little bit there about telling a lie. They tell a lie to Cillian Murphy, which Mark Grant is like,
yes, I meant to mention that as another example of the whole sort of weaving a story thing.
I mean, I thought that was great. I just wanted more of it. I don't know what you think about the other characters in Dunkirk.
I mean, I think that is a film, that's kind of the film within the film.
I would watch again.
That's the only direct narrative through line. And have you seen Their Finest this year?
No, I haven't yet. No.
So basically the heart of Their Finest is built around the Dunkirk story, which is similar, about two girls who steal their dad's boat to go and pick up people at Dunkirk. You know, it's a plucky,
what a sensible idea,
a Mrs. Miniver-esque plucky propaganda movie. So and it's all there. It is quite, if it was on its own, it would be quite hokey, I think, without everything going on around it. I mean, the quality of the acting is great there, though. Mark Rylance is now doing Mark Rylance for me.
Really? Oh, I always thought he was stunning.
He's like, I'll pick a slightly off-kilter British accent. I'll downplay it a bit. I'll look down at my feet quite a lot. And we'll be stoical when I need to be, you know. Does it help? Yeah, it helps.
Yeah, I found him more a bit more of a shtick in Bridge of what's it?
Bridge of Spies.
Well,
Spies and Bridges, I don't know.
in Bridge of Spies, where he's playing a Geordie, but he can't do a Geordie accent, so he does a completely different accent.
I sort of thought, oh God, he's doing it again, but I also was very impressed at the same time, especially because some of the lines that Christopher Nolan gave him, I just thought in another actor they would be so cheesy.
The
way he underplays them, it does work. And I thought he's when he's standing up front and his son, and he's saying, oh, you know, it's not bother going, they're all dead. And the way he played that, I thought was excellent.
Yeah.
And the slight hokiness, I couldn't. It definitely in a film of its own, it would have been too much. But it's also, I found it a little bit jarring, some of that, in the context of the rest of it as well. The whole storyline with the boy falling down the stairs. I don't know. I'd like to see it again because I can't quite make up my mind about that whole that whole strand. But I did think Cillian Murphy was a great character in that sense. I think he was the kind of the most interesting part of it for me. And I do think it's notable that the death that the whole film focuses on most was such a unheroic, you know, unheroic one by our own, inflicted by our own side.
On a civilian.
Yeah.
On a sort of, you know, very vulnerable civilian as well. Yeah, yeah, I mean, Cillian Murphy's fantastic. I've watched him at Peaky Blinders. I really thought he was going to come out of that locked room with a blade and, you know, take matters into his own hands. Yeah. Then, because I found it just the and the revelation at the end about Mark Rylance's oldest son and things like that, I found that all to be a complete story. And then I was a bit worried by the other characters seem to be locked in stasis a little bit. You know, there's not much room to develop in an hour in one fight, I know. I didn't get any insight into Tom Hardy's psychology as to why he would surrender, apart from the fact that he had to, he was forced to. But somehow the way they made it look noble, and I didn't understand what was going on there. You don't get to know Tom Hardy, do you?
Can you ever know Tom Hardy? All I know is he steals sugar in cinema adverts, and beyond that, and you know, he will fight you.
Yeah, but I mean, beautiful man. And again, with the young boys.
To me, he was just the kind of heroic, professional kind of thing. That's all. Yeah. I mean, he did it very well, but it wasn't... there wasn't much to his character in that sense, no.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he can do a lot, you know. I thought he was going to get home and pour some cement, you know. That's why he was driving so, you know, flying so fast. Yeah, he can do a lot, but, you know, again, you know, how can you act in a cockpit with a mask on? It's hard. Let me ask you, Nick. Is it eyebrow work? No,
They didn't make me do Bane in the film. But it is strange how he's been in a mask.
Of course, you wouldn't have been Bane.
Christopher Nolan films, isn't it?
He hates his chin.
And he's got a beautiful face, as people have pointed out. You know, and again, I mean, I think, you know, you'd have to have a very hard heart not to sympathise with Fionn Whitehead, absolutely. Yeah. But there is a little bit of what they show, quite rightly, is that there are hundreds other like him, you know. And so, again, you don't have the pleasures of character in that way. What about Coronel? Were there any characters that you fell for? So which boat did you like best, basically?
I'm a big Invincible man myself.
I like Inflexible just because... the idea of just like Inflexible being a good thing, which, you know, nowadays it's only ever used in a derogatory way. Like
by Prime Ministers.
Inflexible.
I mean, if I were, you know, building a destroyer, I'd quite like it to be Inflexible. Impenetrable.
Finished.
Impermeable. Finished.
Rather than it's sailing ready or not.
Probably riveted. Yeah.
No, there are no characters.
Sorry, we've drifted away from the characters.
Fewer characters. There are types, aren't there?
I mean, there is Grosby. There is, you know, who's an odd one for you to go and root for. And you don't root for him, but he is somebody who turns up. There is the Admiral, who I forget the name of, but he's there with his grizzled face and is banging on the table.
It's very much types. Like the sailor and the soldier, I think, you know, in the London scene where it says, what are you going to do about that then? Same as what you did at Mons. Yeah. I have to say, when talking about realism, I meant to say this, Coronel's dialogue, despite being a silent film, far more naturalistic than Christopher Nolan's. Definitely. I think that's the dialogue's really great in that film.
Yeah, there is a lot of it, as you said. There's one section that sort of goes on with about sort of five intervals in a row.
I know. Make a cup of tea, right?
And they're quite innovative with their intertitles as well. There's quite a lot of stuff on paperwork. There's that one superposed.
On the horizon. Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. They don't want to talk about characterization, but they do want to show you about how many people of different types are involved at every level. Yeah. So you've got the signalers and things like that. You know,
it's a procedure, isn't it, in some ways?
Very much so, yeah.
And so it's to show all that. Because also, that's their audience. It's like my school play when everyone was in it. So all their parents went, even if after school, just trooped across the stage at one point, waving cheerily. They've been in the play.
So I think really what we're boiling down is, do we applaud the creation of identifiable types, or do we applaud Christopher Nolan for giving us some great characters and some really bad ones? I think I'm going to vote for Dunkirk. I'm going to be honest.
I'm going to vote for Dunkirk as well.
I'm going to vote for Coronel.
Ooh.
Just because, I just thought it was a notable weakness in some parts for me in Dunkirk. So.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk.
I'm not going back.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
If we go there, we'll die.
You see it from here.
What?
Home.
So we're onto our final category, and it's the one that I think we all really needed to talk about from the beginning. But, you know, if we had started with it, we'd have been here all day.
Well, I think we've moved our structure, our narrative structure, to to move the most important thing to the end.
Yeah, it's like really clever how I've put this in a place you didn't expect it. So narrative and strategy. So obviously Dunkirk does a clever thing with timelines. Now,
it does a thing with timelines.
What would you say, Nick?
So I think people come to it with a little bit of baggage because they know what Christopher Nolan's done before. Which kind of, and I think...
Oh, which has often been so successful, like really successful.
I don't think he's trying to be that clever, and I don't think it is that clever. I just think it, you know, it's a way of weaving the three stories together, and it sort of pulls you up a little bit when you see Cillian Murphy suddenly in the section you're not expecting. But it's not, I don't think it's something you're supposed to pay much attention to, really. It's just, you know, the way he tells the story to get the three strands in. Yeah.
I think there's an active problem with the last segments of the film where we do get where the week and the hour and the minute and the day all coincide, and we get to see the same events from different viewpoints. Sometimes it works very well. There's the ditched pilot where at one point we see him waving on Tom Hardy, and then latterly we see why he's waving.
Yeah.
That's good. That's clever. That's Rashomon-y. I know you hate Rashomon, but, you know.
I just like women, sorry.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Well, you must have loved Dunkirk.
And Coronel.
I told you we should have done the Guild.
This is why I got two men in the studio, just so I could recreate the experience of just feeling completely invisible. Yeah, we should have done the Guild.
But it does become problematic. I think because everything just falls into one, and you don't quite get the meaning of it. And I think the problem I have with it is in the end is that these periods of time which are picked are great to show certain aspects of it, but they are way too simple. 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour, when actually, you know, that trip from over to Dunkirk, it never feels like a day. Mm-hmm. It's never night. We never see it be night time.
I think that sort of feels like a day, but I got no sense of a week.
Yeah,
absolutely no sense of a week. And I think that's really important.
That's really important.
A whole week waiting. Well, the whole event, was it 10 days or a fortnight?
10 days.
Yeah. But I never felt like a week. I love narrative tricksiness.
You do?
Yeah, anyone who knows me knows that. But I did not get behind this strategy at all. I really thought I would. I thought I'd like it because I got a sense of pleasure when you see things that have already happened or haven't happened yet, and you can spot people in the other timelines. But it just failed to create a story for me. I didn't feel... It felt like it was trying to stop me identifying or getting involved. So visually, it's trying to immerse you, but with the narrative, it denies you any kind of story, if you know what I mean. There wasn't a story, even though there was lots of plot, and that's why all the sentiment at the end feels unearned to me. I thought that having no idea of the strategy of the operation, as well as the strategy of the narrative, they were both two sides of the same coin, really. It's a bit like not seeing the enemy. I felt we were missing a vital component which would have helped with the suspense and sort of understanding of the peril that they were facing, just to know how many boats may or may not be on their way and things like that. It got to the point where you sort of felt like you didn't need to listen to the occasional bit of useful exposition.
I mean, there's one line, I think, one or two lines on with Ken Branagh, when they want 3,000 people back, and they're going to be sending the boats pleasure cruisers and weekend yachtsmen. And apart from that, that's about it. And I think there is both films have a bit of a problem with foreknowledge. You know, what does he expect the audience to know about? And I think Coronel, people at the time will have known of it. It was a big battle. Both of them were big battles. They know what the outcome was. They might not know the ins and outs, but they knew the outcomes of the battles, and they knew the outcome of the war.
Yeah.
Now, Dunkirk is a slightly different kettle of fish from where we are now. I think
this is like the end of the phony war, isn't it?
Yeah. If you're British, you know Dunkirk in as much as you know of it as an evacuation. Mm. The rest of the world probably don't know that at all in the same sort of way. It's not a big thing there. But even if you know about Dunkirk, you still don't. I think we're way past the bit where everyone knows the, you know, weekend yachtsmen and pleasure boats and all that, which in itself wasn't strictly true anyway. There was some of that, but they were doing the little ferrying out to the big boats, and they were mainly requisitioned.
Yeah.
So there is I guess how much it's treating you like a grown-up that you know these things, and how much it's actually saying, you don't really need to know this because we're just going to be throwing you in the mix, and this is what it feels like.
Yeah, but then, if it's just a roller coaster, it's just a roller coaster.
Yeah.
Well, I think I defend it in that I think it's deliberately not trying to give a clear story, because I think it's resisting the idea that there is a clear kind of story to it, and it's just lots of individual stories. And I suppose that's, and I think I did feel then it did feel a bit too cute at the end, but then I suppose the other side of that is that it's, again, it's from their perspective, so there is a huge amount of sentimentality that's grown from nostalgia for home. So yes, it might seem cheesy to us that we have the pictures of the cliffs and stuff and they want to see them, but I didn't get a lot out of the ending, but I just sort of rationalised it. This was just the way they saw it, and there was a kind of element of unreality to the way they saw it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, Nolan interview I listened to last week talks about the end and sort of says, well, you know, people are really kind of, you know, the younger viewer these days, they're more au fait with the open ending, you know, something where things aren't finished, because they see all these multi-universe films where, you know, they end looking for a sequel. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to make a sequel, but there are all these other stories, and that's, you know, the war doesn't end then. It's like, that's kind of a cop-out.
I think that is, it's a bit of a weird thing to say, because really, like, the sequel that you'd expect from Dunkirk, the sequel that is set up from Dunkirk, is a battle in Britain, basically.
Of India.
Yeah, of Britain. Yeah, you know. So it's setting you up for a sequel that doesn't happen. The fact that they walk away, I completely think that's exactly, you hit the nail on the head saying that you're resisting the idea that there is one clear narrative. But then they sort of want to have their cake and eat it a little bit by suggesting there is, and sort of having those heroic shots of Tom Hardy with flames. I was just really confused, because I was so ready to like this bit of it most. And especially with the ending, I think I would, if you'd have yanked me out of the cinema 15 minutes before the end of the film, I'd have been talking about 5 stars, 4 stars, you know, and now I'm definitely talking about 4 stars, maybe less.
I mean, considering that the ending is done mainly with long shots, music and voiceover, do we think this is the original ending? Because it feels like, actually, that if you think about it that way, you think, I need, you know, I showed it to people and it had an ending where people just got on the train and that was it, which might have been the one that we would prefer, but people going, we want to a bit more.
I don't remember the voiceover. What was the
voiceover? Well, when he does the beaches one.
Oh, I see, the beaches. Yeah, yes, of course.
So it's not like an extra voiceover. I read in that interview in Sight and Sound that Christopher Nolan, you know, was saying, oh, I'm 46 and I'm really conscious that it's people my age send young people into war, and that's why I had young actors, and I feel that this is really a key thing. And I just thought, make a film about that. If that's something you passionately feel, I think that's why the Mark Rylance sequence works so well. I was like, make a film about the story you want to tell, even if the story is, yes, it's complicated, but I didn't feel that there was any passion in the narrative that made you think this is why he wanted to tell us about Dunkirk, apart from, like, wouldn't it be a staggering experience to see what it was like at Dunkirk? Whereas Coronel is like a masterclass in how to tell people what is going on in a film. We've got every kind of clock and calendar and telegram. Maybe it's a bit too much. Like,
yeah, there were an awful lot of cutaways to various gauges, and yes.
I think it's really interesting that you said, having watched it the first time, that actually left you feeling less sure of where you were, even though constantly trying to tell you exactly what's happening.
Yeah, I think that's probably my own failing, as I'm just not very good at
it. Because, you know, it can be a bit of a bombardment of information, I suppose, if they think some of it might be familiar. But
yeah, I think that is, and also I think the idea that up to that point there were the war drama documents or documentaries were very much about, here are the boats, this is what, you know, here is a map of what happened. There are no maps really here. There are no, we don't see manoeuvres the way that you would do in some of those other
maps.
Films.
That's really good. Yeah, which were quite popular in First World War films, yeah. I think, at the time. But there's just the time, the relentless ticking clock. If Walter Summers had commissioned a score, it might have sounded very much, might have used the shepherd note or whatever it's called.
Yeah,
you know, and so, you know, you watch Coronel, and this might be a good or bad thing, but you kind of know what he's trying to make you feel. Mm. You know, at the end of the day, we've seen Britain be defeated, regroup, and then be victorious again. Plus, we've also been a little bit magnanimous on the other side, so it's not entirely impossible to watch it.
It's the entire First World War in microcosm. I mean, it is a model of the war. We lose a bit and we win.
Yeah.
And we're a bit magnanimous.
And you know,
well, I mean, they're trying to tell a story about who the British are, I suppose, in a way that I don't know if Christopher Nolan really is interested in doing that.
I'm not so sure, actually, because I think there is a sense in Dunkirk where he is trying to say, this is what the British are like, and they are like everyone else. They are a bit rubbish, a bit venal, but they will survive because they will, you know, people will survive, but they won't survive due to being better than anyone else. They'll survive due to a bit of dumb luck and being in the right place at the right time. Mm. I'm not sure he gets that across very well, but I do get a sense that there is, despite the French stuff and all that stuff, there is an internationalist at heart there, that he's not saying that this is a peculiarly British trait.
But on what basis is it saying that this is these people are the same as anyone else?
I think because he doesn't really talk about any kind of exceptionalism. He never says that these people are exceptional for getting out of the situation. So I guess to me that means it feels universal.
Right.
But that's kind of my take on that.
I suppose
that,
just the kind of... It doesn't feel international to me, partly because of the absence of the others, but also because the whole... I mean, this is obviously just events of history, but the whole thing is a pullback home, which is a very kind of... It is difficult at the moment with Brexit around, which I think is the first time this word has been mentioned in this podcast. But without intending it, obviously, because it all happened, you know, he started making it long before, that kind of heading back to shore aspect of it is sort of... is maybe difficult.
No, I can see that. I
it doesn't feel outward looking.
I think anything like this can be read in different ways, and I think a Brexit audience, as we know from Mr. Farage, will read it in a different way, you know.
I mean, I think Mr. Farage's intervention in our cinephile pleasure, which has been very welcome, it's part of that thing that I think it's tricky with both films. They've got this. They know that people will say, this is an important event. It's probably important to watch the film, or the film is important. And it's like, well, no, not necessarily. It's not necessarily important to watch either of these films. You know, it's not something you should do or shouldn't do. There might be other ways to engage with the other aspects of history. But once you are making a film that treats real life events and quite important global events, you know, do you have a responsibility to the people who were there, perhaps, to tell their story in a way that is particularly fitting? Now, Walter Summers might be over-burdened and over-worried about that, but I feel like Christopher Nolan he said, I'm not interested in politics. You know, I'm not sure that he has decided this is the story about Dunkirk that I think should be told. And that's fine. I mean, he's gone rogue, hasn't he? Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
I guess the big question there is that, you know, what you always expect at the end of a film like Dunkirk is the big title card that explains what happened, right? The
35,000
people got home. And then you can make your pointy political statement you want of X number of French were also evacuated, considering how they're treated in the film.
Mm-hmm.
The number of Poles, you know, the Indian soldiers who were on the beach, which we don't see. But, you know, we see one black French soldier.
Two or three black
French soldiers at the beginning. But from a Nolan's perspective, he doesn't want to do that because that would spoil the film. And whether there's a responsibility to do that sometimes goes back to your question, I guess. And I think maybe there was a responsibility to do that.
He's got, you know, Tommy dropping his trousers on the beach. You know, he's telling you this is not going to be the most respectful film from the beginning, I think, you know. I mean, maybe there's a respect in realism itself.
Yeah, no, I don't think there is. But we are not in a position where there are that many people to confirm it now. I mean, Dunkirk survivors will be turning 100 more or less this year, around that age.
It's terrifying, isn't it? But, you know, people who grow up on the stories, that's the thing, isn't it? You know,
but the stories are the stories.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of feel like Christopher Nolan attempted something really admirable, really. This idea of saying there are no stories in war, it's just hell, this is just the murk of it. I'm going to interweave these timelines to show you how messy and complicated and unsatisfactory these whole things are. I'm not sure that it actually succeeded for me, whereas Walter Summers tried to do something much simpler and just absolutely nailed it. So it depends whether you're marking for ambition or achievement here, I think, and I'm quite conflicted, much as I'm voting for Coronel.
He is aiming it for something, and I'm not absolutely sure what it is, because he's not just trying to do a, like, well, there's no, it's meaningless to try and put a narrative on this. He's not doing like Steven Soderbergh did with Che or something, where you're just really being documentary and just like, there's just no kind of compromise to making a kind of narrative. It's just like, this supposedly has it happened. One thing after the other. But
he puts one thing before another.
I don't know exactly what he's aiming for, but I'm veering towards agreeing with you on the scoring.
But, you know, £100 million or whatever, $100 million, whatever, I wonder what goes through your head if you're thinking, I'm going to spend all this money on just showing you how bloody horrible it is.
I think reducing it to being horrible is not... I think that part of it is better characterised as kind of realism, I suppose, more than just horror, because obviously it's not going all out on it being horrific. It's just kind of the sense of being there, I suppose.
It's just... Yeah, it's just an opportunity to say something. Yeah, or not. Maybe it's like those people who don't vote. My statement is that I'm not voting. My statement is I'm not saying anything.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if he'd gone for a linear narrative, then he wouldn't have been able to tell the three stories the way he tells them. Because they wouldn't have fit the way they do.
I only want one story.
Yeah, and if you only want, you know, Mr. Dawson, fine. And so that's why he does it. Mm. I do think that he has, once he's identified doing it, he's given himself a bigger bone to chew,
yeah,
and kind of fluffs it. Mm. But you know, I champion his ambition, but I'm going to vote for Coronel.
So could we have a Hans Zimmer suspense raising drum roll, please? It really is effective, isn't it? So I can relieve the tension now by giving you some privacy on a sand dune and tell you that the winner of our incredibly scientific exercise was the Battles of Coronel and Falkland Islands, which scored 10 points to Dunkirk's 8. So it was quite close.
Pretty close.
It was close. I mean, was it a defeat that was as glorious as a victory?
It is
Dunkirk?
A defeat. Easily had defeat.
Do you know what's embarrassing? I hadn't. Yeah. I'm just that cheesy, Nick.
I mean, we obviously spent 3/4 of our time talking about Dunkirk. And because there is a lot of meat on that chop, but
I mean, you know, I was so excited to see Dunkirk. I have to admit, it doesn't sound like it. I was super, super psyched to the extent that I was like, never mind about The Beguiled, which I watched the night after and I liked a lot more. So it's victory for Walter Summers, long may he reign, and it's a humiliation for Christopher Nolan, who, I mean, I'm afraid we've ruined his career now, and with it we've taken down the entire British film industry.
I'd say good try, Christopher. Come back in 4 years' time with your next movie. We'll see what we can do for you.
We'll see what we can do on a micro budget.
Yeah,
and you know, I think it's interesting and completely proves Mr. Nolan right that, you know, I think Nick was the most impressed with the film out of all of us, and you saw it in the proper format. Yeah. I would very much like to go back and see it again.
Yeah, if you have a chance, do. Yeah. It is quite...
I'm not hating on 70mm. And thank you so much for listening to The Sound Barrier. Dunkirk is out in cinemas now on a variety of formats. The Battles of Coronel and Falkland Islands is available on DVD and Blu-ray and to stream on the BFI Player Plus subscription service. The Sound Barrier is presented in association with SOAS Radio, so thanks to them. Thanks to Pete.
Thank you.
And thanks to the lovely Nick for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
If you have any suggestions for films we could match up, then please do let us know in the comments on silentlondon.co.uk or tweet us at Silent London. You can find more episodes of the Silent London podcast on the website, as well as on iTunes or Stitcher. Now, the next episode of The Sound Barrier will be with you in a fortnight, and we'll be announcing the films for that instalment in advance if you'd like to watch what we're watching. Goodbye.